Good evening. Welcome to Congressman Mike Capuano's telephone community meeting. My name is Allison, and I thank you for joining us tonight. If you have a question for Congressman Capuano at any point during tonight's telephone community meeting, just press *3. We will post an audio file of tonight's discussion on our website when it's available. If you'd like to access that file, or if you'd like to sign up for Congressman Capuano's electronic newsletter, please visit our website at capuano.house.gov. If you do have a question tonight for Congressman Capuano, please press *3. And now Congressman Capuano would like to say a few words. Congressman?
Thanks, Allison. I want to thank everyone for joining us. I know there'll be people coming in and going out during this call. We expect to be on for about an hour. Basically, just by way of introduction, I just want to thank everyone for being with us, and I'm just calling tonight, really, to hear from constituents about what's on their mind. I've heard from a lot of people over the last few weeks since the election, especially, about concerns about the new administration and about issues regardless of who the administration is. There are obviously some local issues that are important and some national issues. And I will tell you right from the get-go that I'm afraid to tell you that a lot of the questions that I'll be asked tonight, I expect a lot of my answers will be I don't know, because I can't predict the future, no different than anyone else. I will be happy to give everybody my best estimate for what might happen and to just discuss what's on your mind. So with that, I think I'm going to stop, see if I'm hoping there are people that are in the queue already to ask questions. If you have a question, please press *3, and that will enter you in the line. And if we can get to you tonight, we will. And if we can't, there will be an opportunity to leave a question at the end of the night. So with that, I'm hoping we have some people online. I think I'm going to stop, and let's see where the people that I represent. What do you want to talk about?
All right. As the Congressman said, if you do have a question tonight, please press *3. And our first caller is Linda, who would like to talk about Congressman Paul Ryan and some of the plans that he might have in mind. Linda, when you're ready.
Yes, I would like commentary on this privatization. It sounds very radical. And is this intended only for future Medicare, or is it imminent as soon as Republicans can get to it?
I can't answer the second question. I don't know when they'll get to it, but it has been in Paul Ryan's budget since day one. I actually think that my Democratic friends made a big mistake not publicizing that aspect of it the day he proposed it, which is now, I don't know, 8 years ago. And I don't know when they will get to it. I think that now it's like the dog has caught the bus. The Republicans now run the House, the Senate, and the White House. In theory, they should be able to adopt every single plan they've proposed. But I think that some of their proposals, and I hope that privatizing Medicare is one of them, I'm afraid that now we'll have to wait and see. If they do, it will be a major fight, obviously. We have problems with the healthcare system, but one of the problems, there is not a single way I can see it as a solution to privatize Medicare. It will take it out of the hands of the general public and put it into the hands of people who must make a profit. Medicare is not a profit-making entity, it needs to be fixed. It needs more revenue, but I generally get comments nothing other than pure and unadulterated love for Medicare. So we'll see. I do think they're going to have to back off some of their more radical proposals. This is certainly one of them, and I think they'll have to find a way around it. But this is not a joke. Paul Ryan has been saying this for years. Republicans have been saying it for generations, that they hate Medicare. And now we'll have to wait and see what they do. Obviously, for governmental reasons and personal reasons, I hope they never do it. I hope they find a way not to do it. But if they do, what I can tell you is it will be the biggest fight of the year, maybe the biggest fight of my lifetime. But I just don't know if and when they will actually propose it.
If you're just joining us tonight and you have a question for Congressman Capuano, please press *3. Joe is joining us now with a question about President-elect Trump's foreign policy. Joe, your question?
Well, it goes like this. I understand a little about checks and balances when it comes to domestic issues and legislation and so forth and so on, but what I'm really concerned about is Donald Trump. He's shown to be a maverick in so many ways, and when it comes to foreign policy and in particular hot button issues, what are we going to do, or how can we pull in his reins when he goes too far, if you get my drift?
I do. I think that's a good question, Joe. Again, one of, like I said, right from the beginning, there are going to be many of these I can't answer. I'll give you an example. I was one of the handful of people in the House who sued President Obama. And I'm a big Obama supporter. I thought he was a good president. I was happy to be a supporter. But I thought he went too far when he decided to lob U.S. missiles into Libya. Not because I opposed the situation. I didn't have time to make a determination because we were never asked. I just thought the president should have come to the House pursuant to the law, pursuant to the Constitution, and asked the House to declare an act of war against Libya or any other place he wants to engage. I think the Constitution is pretty clear about that. If Trump does it, it's going to be very interesting to see if I stand alone again. I think there was four of us that sued the president in that one. I hope not. I hope the American people stand tall, and any president, not just Donald Trump, I think any president is required and should be enforced to come to the House of Representatives for a declaration of war. If you throw a missile at an independent country, even if you don't like that country, that's an act of war. President Roosevelt got it when they attacked Pearl Harbor. George Bush got it with Iraq. Now, I voted against that, but at least he came to the House and asked our permission. And I would say the same thing here. I will be very active and very vehement, and I hope the House finds its own backbone. Again, not because I would support or not support any given action by the president, but because war and peace impacts us all, and that is not the way a democracy is supposed to work. We'll wait and see. If it turns out to be nothing but partisan politics, well, then I believe that's very, very bad for our Constitution, for our democracy, and our way of life.
If you have a question tonight for Congressman Capuano, please press *3. Shirley is joining us now with a question about drug prices. Shirley, your question?
Hi. Hi.
Hi, Shirley.
Hi. How are you? Sorry, I have a little laryngitis. I'm talking to, and I want to know why the pharmaceutical companies can just raise their prices anytime they want. I mean, it happened to me yesterday when I went to get my husband's insulin. From last month, it was $48 for one vial, and last night they wanted $130. So it jumped that much in 1 month. I just want to know what's going on. Why they're not being stopped?
Very simply,
they can do what they want.
Well, very simply, in the absent government action, any private company can charge anything they want for any item. The only thing that can limit prices is government action. In America, it has been very underutilized, as far as, especially when it comes to drug prices. And I'll tell you why. It's kind of simple to me. Almost everyone who buys drugs now has some sort of health insurance cover, either through the Obamacare or through their own private insurance company. Most people have some sort of drug coverage. And that being the case, the best way to control drug prices is not to mandate a given price. But to simply say to these companies, we will pay you the average price that is paid in all the other countries you sell this drug. And I say that because most of the countries that they want to sell their drugs in, mostly in Europe and South America and Japan, have nationalized health care. The country itself, the government of those countries, England, France, Germany, Sweden, on and on and on, they negotiate any drug that's sold to their company is pursuant to a negotiated price between the government and the drug manufacturer. And if they don't want to sell it at that price, then they don't sell it. Kind of simple. The drug company has to make a decision. Can we make a profit at this price or not? And what ends up happening is that pretty much the drugs cost the same price in England as they do in France, as they do in Germany and Italy. It's pretty much the same price. And the company comes back here to America where there is no government intervention whatsoever. No negotiations, and they simply make up the difference. By the way, I want to add Canada to that list, too. That's how Canada does it. And very simply, when we passed the drug bill years ago, the Congress, and I voted no, but the Congress put in a provision that prohibited the United States government from negotiating prices with drug companies. I find that to be offensive. And again, I'm not opposed to drug companies making profits. Profit is the American way, and I want the next new invention for a new drug. I don't want to kill invention. But there is a balance. Where the balance is, I think that's a matter of the company saying we can make a profit at this. We can't make at this level. We can't make a profit at that level. All that being said, if we simply said we will pay the average price that is paid in a basket of other companies, again, Canada, England, France, Germany, we'll pay that average price. They would then have to raise their prices in the other companies and therefore lower the U.S. price. Right now, in my opinion, we are subsidizing the cost of drugs for the people of Canada, the people of England, the people of Italy, because their government is not afraid to negotiate on their behalf. I believe it is was a huge mistake made by the United States. It is a huge mistake that continues and can be rectified by congressional action. I don't expect that to happen at the moment. The people now in charge, the Republicans in the House, and the Senate, and the White House, have been very vehement that they do not believe in government intervention in the private sector. Well, I believe it should be limited, but I do believe it should happen on occasion. This is one of those situations. And until that happens, drug companies will be able to charge anything they want, anytime they want it. And I just don't think that's fair or right.
If you're just joining us tonight and you have a question for Congressman Capuano, please press *3. Dorothy is joining us now with a question about Social Security. Dorothy?
Yes. Representative, I've just received a notice from Social Security that there, as of January 2017, there's going to be an increase of 0.03. But then further on, it says the monthly amount is going to stay the same. So that doesn't show any increase at all.
There probably won't be much of an increase this year. And that is done by pursuant to a formula that's been in place for, I don't know, 60 years. They determine what the inflationary factors are. There have been many of us that have tried to change that formula to better reflect the actual cost to seniors in America, the actual cost of living for seniors in America. A lot of those estimated costs are based on things that seniors don't necessarily spend money on and younger people do. Until that changes, these increases are going to be very, very low for the coming future for many, many years to come. And I don't think it's fair to watch senior citizens be slowly squeezed by the lack of appropriate and fair increases in the Social Security. But that's what it is now. It's a mathematical formula. It requires Congress to go in and change that formula. We have done it once or twice before. Since I've been here, we've done it once or twice. We could do it again, and I would argue we should do it, and we should do it on a permanent basis.
Our next question is from Peter, who would like to talk about some of President-elect Trump's appointments. Peter, your question?
I thank you. When the volunteer army was put together, there was a great concern that going from the general population to a professionalized army, military, that it could intrude on the political process. To date, there's been great care, particularly thankfully from the military, to honor that wall of separation between military and politic. With the number of generals that seem to be accumulating and the number of sources of input from which Trump operates on generally, are we reaching a point where that wall is becoming vulnerable?
I think you're understating it. I think it's going to be crashed down probably tomorrow. There is a bill coming to the floor that includes a provision to waive the 7-year wait period for a retired general to be named the Secretary of Defense. I think that is a horrendous mistake for the reasons you just mentioned. The United States has a long, proud tradition of non-military leaders at the Department of Defense. If it was anything else, it would be called the Department of War. This is not a warmongering society, and that doesn't mean that all generals are. It just means that the best way to do that, to remind the military that they work for the people of America, is to have a private citizen who runs it. It has happened in I don't know how long, but for all modern history, with one exception, and that was George Marshall immediately after World War II. But I'm afraid to tell you that I believe that provision will be included in the continuing resolution that we were supposed to vote on tomorrow, and I expect that provision will be retained and that the bill will pass. At the moment, I expect to vote no on that bill. There's a few more things I want to check out before I make a final decision, but that is one of the many reasons, because I think your concerns are very legitimate.
If you're just joining us and you have a question tonight for Congressman Capuano, please press *3. Martha is joining us now with a question about potential housing cuts. Martha?
Thank you for this forum. Do you expect there to be major cuts in HUD funding to low-income housing programs, or possibly because this is so high in their list of priorities, it will take a while?
Martha, again, this is one of the main questions. I can't give you a definitive answer. I don't think they're going to come in and slash and burn. I think I'm more afraid of the slow squeeze and the regulatory aspects that they do. So that they provide. Remember, a lot of the money that we provide for housing is actually money provided to private developers to develop housing. That's not all we do now, but that's what a lot of where the money goes. That your tax dollars goes to private developers to encourage them to build senior housing, veterans housing, low income housing, and the like. If that money went directly to poor people, and some does, goes directly to public housing authorities, I do think you will see that slowly squeeze down over the next several years. It's been happening for a while. It's not new. That's one of the reasons why you find in pretty much every major urban area, housing costs have gone up, because there's less and less and less government support for this thing. All that being said, again, we'll know better within the next 6 months, but I think your fears are legitimate, but if I had to guess, I don't think they're going to come in for the immediate slash and burn on housing or pretty much anything else. I mean, heck, they're even backing off their slash and burn promises for Obamacare. They're now kind of trying to find a way to do what they want to do over a period of time, which, of course, is impossible, but that's a different issue. But I think it'll be a slower strangulation more than it will be an immediate slash and burn, but we'll see.
We have a question tonight for Congressman Capuano. Please press *3. Mark is joining us now with a question about marijuana legalization in Massachusetts. Mark, your question?
Hi. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah. All right. So I had a question for Mr. Capuano about the legalization of marijuana and the loopholes that will be associated once this law goes into effect on the 15th or the 1st of next year, whatever it is. There's obviously still going to be drug dealers out there selling marijuana untaxed. And also these people who are going to be growing it, these quote-unquote caretakers, how much taxes are they going to be paying, and what is the deal with that? And it just seems so confusing, and I just wanted to know how it's going to work aside from the dispensaries and all that.
Well, Mark, I mean, first of all, that'll be done at the state level, not at the federal level, and so therefore I won't be directly and personally engaged in that conversation other than as a private citizen like everyone else. But as I understand it, the state will probably suspend the law for a while they straighten a lot of questions out. I told people during the election that I supported the decriminalization of marijuana, but I also strongly supported the concept of suspending this particular draft of the law for a short period of time so that the legislature can address a lot of unanswered questions, some of which you just mentioned, but there have been others mentioned as well. So I expect that that's what will happen. That I don't know if it'll happen on the 15th. I don't know exactly when the law takes place, but I think it'll happen quickly. That the legislature will probably suspend the implementation of the law for a given period of time, 6 months, 9 months, whatever it will be, so that they will have time to work out those very questions so that it really can be implemented effectively.
Phoebe is joining us now with a question about human rights in China. Phoebe, your question?
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I'm calling from Boston, and I'm a carpenter, and I hurt my back about 8 years ago, and a friend of mine introduced me to a meditation sort of martial art called Falun Dafa.
Yep.
And after learning it, I helped my back a lot, and I also found out that it was singled out by the communist government in China to be suppressed, and there's an ongoing persecution of peaceful people in China. And I'm really concerned about it and what our government is going to do to stand up for it, you know, especially considering that it seems like China has more and more influence and power here in the U.S., and I'm wondering, you know, what you think we can do to ensure the rights of Falun Dafa practitioners in China and human rights all around the world and at home.
Thank you. This is not a new issue. China has been suppressing this particular group for a long time. I consider myself, I'm very proud of my record on human rights. I stand tall for people's abilities and rights to do whatever they want, religious practices, activities of any kind, as long as they're not threatening to other people. This is not a threatening entity. The Chinese government has a long tradition of getting very nervous and very repressive whenever they see a large group of people doing something that they did not themselves authorize. And that's what happened here. They found a large group of people who practiced Falun Gong, and they went after them. They did the same thing with the Roman Catholic Church. I personally have met with the head of the so-called Chinese Catholic Church. And again, I don't mind what any religion anybody practices, but, you know, I asked the gentleman whether he was part of the Roman Catholic Church. He said yes, but he is not. They have their own church they set up because they didn't like the idea of the Roman Catholic Church, in their estimation, answering to Rome, which, of course, that's a misinterpretation of the religion, but so be it. Anyway, all that being said, I can only tell you that China has a very difficult and very questionable and troubling experience with human rights across the board. This is one of them. And they do crack down every once in a while, and when they do, we speak up and try to keep the pressure on. I think the best we can do is to simply continue to spread the word. And this is not the only group that they do this to. I would like to see a situation where all the groups that are repressed in China get together, and if you can repress one, you can repress everybody. And again, that is the difference, that's the basic difference between a communist society and a democratic society. In a democratic society, you are free to be who you are, to practice your activities or religion or whatever it might be on your own, as long as you're not bothering anybody else. And China, that's just not the case. You can only do what the government allows you to do, and this is one of those situations. So this is one that's going to take some vigilance. I don't know that we'll make progress, but we have to call them on it every time they do it, on every situation, not just one.
If you have a question tonight for Congressman Capuano, please press star 3. Hillary is joining us now with a question about the 21st Century Cures Act. Hillary, your question?
Hi, good evening. I want to thank you for holding this meeting tonight and also for taking my question. I'm calling about the 21st Century Cures Bill because I know it's been voted in favor for in the Senate, and I'm actually quite concerned about the dangerous and harmful effects it might have for Americans. I realize there's a lot of positive provisions in the bill, like funding the opioid crisis. However, I feel that it removes regulations for these big pharmaceutical companies and allows them to market drugs without having them be properly tested and properly approved by the FDA. So I'm just wondering what the next steps are for this bill and if there's anything we can do to have it at least redrafted so that it favors the American public versus, big pharmaceutical companies.
Well, thanks for that, Hillary. This bill is on the president's desk. It just passed the Senate yesterday or today. I'm not sure exactly which day it was. And it passed overwhelmingly, passed the House overwhelmingly because I've been now in Congress quite a while. I have never once voted for a bill or actually against very many bills that are all good or all bad. This is one of them. I voted for this bill, not because I don't share your concerns, but because overall I thought it did more good than it does bad, particularly coming from the greater Boston area where biological research, biochemical research is so important. All that being said, I think, like everything else, this is not one of those situations that is ever going to be done with one bill. This is an evolving business and an evolving science. And healthcare alone, which, of course, is what biotech is all about, is always changing and always in the front pages of debates. We're never going to finish that debate. All that being said, I mean, I think some of your concerns are a little bit stronger than I had. But nonetheless, I think they're valid, and I had some of them. And I can only tell you that, like every bill that we pass, we'll be back at this again in a little while. And a lot of it has to do with regulation, whether the regulators themselves will be vigilant or not. And I hope that they do it in a reasonable way. And if not, we'll come back and see what we need to fix. But, again, this bill right now, this particular bill, is on the president's desk or headed to the president's desk. Oh, but I think he'll probably end up signing it this week. And I hope that your fears don't end up coming to fruition, as I'm sure you hope as well. But we'll see.
If you have a question tonight, please press star 3. Ron is joining us now with a question about Social Security.
Hi, I read recently that Social Security is not a contract between the government and its citizens. Is it true that Congress can spend Social Security funds any way that it chooses?
Can they? They can. They haven't. That's been one of the fallacies from day one. But Social Security needs more funding, to be perfectly honest with you, and it has nothing to do with that. What it has to do with is the changing demographics. When Social Security was passed, I mean, don't hold me to the exact numbers, but the average age was, give or take, the average long age in America was, give or take, 60 years old, 65 years old. Now it's up to sort of getting, pushing, I think, close to 80, if not above 80. People are living longer. They are not working longer because this is time we have to quit. And, again, I don't know the exact number, but it used to be something like there was two people putting in Social Security for every one person taking out, and now it's something like one person putting in for every four people taking out, or something like that. But the concept is right. We need, the demographics of this country have changed, and they've changed for the better. People are living longer and having a more full life, and Social Security was never invented that way. So we have to be honest about it and say that the math just doesn't work the way it once did. We need to get some funding into Social Security. Above that, it's going to end up being cutting benefits, and I don't think anybody thinks that's a good idea. So the bottom line is no, the government cannot just spend the money. I won't say it's a contract, it's a law. Any law can be changed. But it's been a law that has been respected from day one, and I expect and hope it will continue to be respected. There are those who want to privatize it. Thus far, we have defeated those proposals, Paul Ryan being the chief proponent of privatizing. We'll see if they come at it again. If they do, it will be front page news for quite a while, and I hope the American people will speak loudly about that.
Our next caller is John, who has a question about transportation funding under the new administration. John, your question for the congressman?
Yes, thank you. Congressman Capuano, one of the big issues in our district, I'm sure you know, is expanding mass transit. Recently, there's the Green Line extension that is going through Medford, which has been running over budget and behind schedule. But the question I'm asking is, what do you see is an expectation, from your perspective, the impact of a Trump presidency, and particularly the rule of Transportation Chair Elaine Chao's impact on mass transit for the Boston area?
Big question for me. Obviously, mass transit is very important, I think, for the country, but certainly for Massachusetts, and most certainly for greater Boston. It's one of the few things that Trump said during his election that I totally agree with, that this country needs and should have a significant investment in our transit systems. Well, he didn't say transit. He said transportation, but honestly, transit is part of it. And he's a New York City guy, so I presume he understands how important transit is to the overall spectrum of the whole transit needs of this country. So that being the case, I hope and expect that he will live up to his word and support, and not just support, but advocate and submit proposals for significant improvement of our transit system, which means massive investment. We are trillions of dollars behind. Anybody who's traveled abroad knows that. But I can only tell you, again, talk is cheap. He never during the campaign that I know of suggested how it should be paid for. And I can only tell you that I hope he understands that it's perfectly okay. The American people will support investment in infrastructure as long as they get what they pay for. No one wants to waste money. No one wants to build a bridge to nowhere. No one wants that. But we all want not just good transit. We want good highways. We want bikeways so people can bike to work. We want good sidewalks so people can walk. We would love to have a true high-speed rail system. All that being said, I'm looking forward to his proposal that actually implement what he talked about on the campaign trail, which is deep and serious and broad investment in our infrastructure system. And we will know soon enough. I don't think this one can wait. I don't think it will wait. But I do think that he's going to have some trouble on his side of the aisle convincing some of his Republican friends that it is worth paying for. I think he'll have significantly less problems on the Democratic side of the aisle convincing us that it's worth paying for. But, again, one of the many things that we're going to wait and see. This one I don't think will take long to see exactly what he decides to do.
Our next caller is Lisa, who has a question about LGBTQ protections. Lisa, when you're ready, your question.
Hi. So I was just wondering, so President-elect Trump and his vice president-elect have made comments about people in the LGBTQ community, especially Pence, and I was wondering what you think should be done to make people who are openly gay or bisexual or lesbian feel safe in the community.
Well, again, Trump, on this particular issue, Trump has recently said some pretty good things, at least when it comes to at least same-sex marriage, maybe not much else, but it was I hope to provide a nice little bit of sunshine to an otherwise potentially dreary administration. He said it's a settled matter, and it's not a big deal to him. He's not going to bring it up again. Now, we'll see whether he means that, and I hope he does. And if he does, it's not great. It could be a lot better, but at least it's something. And if that happens, it provides, I think, should provide a feeling for people that the President of the United States is not out hunting them down. Now, I will tell you that I've served with Mike Pence, and I think that his feeling on the matter might be different, but thankfully he's not the president. So we'll see. We'll see. I don't think this issue is going to be as bad as some people concern themselves. I don't think we're going to make advancement, but I'm not of the opinion at the moment that the Trump administration will set us back very far at all. There are other areas he'll set us back badly, but we'll fight those when they come. And if they do, I actually think, at least when it comes to same-sex marriage, I'm not sure about other issues, I actually think that battle was won with the hearts and minds of America. I think America is perfectly fine with it. I don't hear the discussion anymore. Or I don't get called names because I support it anymore. So all that being said, I think this issue, though, like everything else with any new administration, particularly this one, it demands vigilance. I feel reasonably comfortable that we will be okay in the long run. And if not, well, again, one of the many things we will know, I think, pretty soon. But I don't want to be Pollyanna about it. I don't want to pretend that I don't want to pretend that everything's fine. But it's one issue that I think we're going to be okay. Wish I could say something stronger.
Our next caller is Drayton, who has a question about income inequality. Your question for the congressman?
Thank you, Congressman Capuano. I'm really concerned about the adverse impacts of income inequality in the United States on society, especially regarding the ever-increasing ratio of what CEOs of companies are making compared to their entry-level and mid-level employees. And I'd like to know what your thoughts are about that and if, you know, you share my concerns, what could be done about that?
I share your concerns so deeply, it's hurtful. It's, to me, if I could pick one thing relative to the economy, that's the major thing. We've had, in the last, in my opinion, in the last 30 to 40 years, there has been a slow, steady march towards keeping money amongst the smaller and smaller group of Americans through tax policy, through regulation, through state tax policy, through inheritance rules and regulations, one thing at a time. And for me, I hate to tell you, I actually think it's un-American. I think America is based, there's nothing wrong with being rich. I'm not criticizing people who are rich at all. You know, God bless them, and we all want to be rich. But there is something wrong with society that says just because you were lucky enough to be born into this family, you get every benefit. You're going to get some benefits anyway, and I don't want to take all the money away from rich people and redistribute it, but I do think that there comes a time when we just don't have an aristocracy where, you know, the same families get to keep the money that was earned for generations. That's not good for society. It's not good. We're not based on that. We are based on meritocracy, and meritocracy means if your father or your mother made a lot of money, good for you. You're going to get a lot of benefits out of that, but now you're going to stand on your own two feet. And if you can do the same thing, good for you. Not a problem. But if you're the idiot child of somebody who did well, it's not good for society for that money to be tied up without contributing to expanding jobs and expanding the economy. All that being said, I couldn't agree with you more. I don't think we're going to make much progress on that in the next few years. I kind of laugh about you know, the whole Trump situation. Did Donald Trump's father do an international search to find him to run the company? Did he do an international search of the most qualified people in the whole world to run his empire by finding his children? Now, maybe that's the case, and that's wonderful, but that's not a democracy to me. That's an aristocracy. And it may not, one family alone is not a big deal, but if you end slowly but surely, you're getting, I don't know how many, pick a number, 10,000 families in this country that are slowly accumulating more and more of the portion of the wealth to our detriment, and I think it's hurting our society in the long run. I don't think the money's being put to the best use to improve the society, to advance us, to compete in the world, to create jobs, to spread the wealth so that everybody can have an opportunity to live a decent life. But right now I think that vision is losing, and I think it's been losing because too many people have bought into this nonsense that somehow, you know, if you earn it, you can keep it, then that's it forever. Taxes are bad at all situation, and that's the end of it, which is fine if we were all multimillionaires. I heard it most prominently when we had the debate on the estate tax. I had working-class people coming up saying, get rid of the death tax. It's like, the death tax? The average person doesn't pay an estate tax. They're exempt from it. And you can obviously, I would agree that we should raise that amount of what the exemption is. But the concept is, was all wrong, but it was pushed by some of the media outlets. It was pushed by some of the media machines we have in this country, and accepted by people for reasons that are just stunning to me. So until the average American wakes up and realizes that it's not just not good for them personally, it's not good for our society to allow this massive and creeping accumulation of wealth amongst fewer and fewer people, we're going to continue on the slow march towards back towards aristocracy.
Bob is joining us now with a question about prescription drug costs. Bob, your question?
Well, my question is, I am 91 years old, and I'm a VA from World War II. I was let out with the 12 conditions, and I'm getting all my free medications and hospitalizations. Why can't the government or whatever, whoever, I don't have any college degrees, why can't they do the same situation as the VA? My pills, if I had to pay with them, I wouldn't be able to do it. I'm on 20 medications. Why is it so difficult? Is it the lobbyist or what? I don't have any college degrees. But this just doesn't seem very, very hard to accomplish for the, especially it should be given to the those elderly that can't afford this high prescription or those that are on welfare or whatever. It doesn't seem to me to be that much of a problem that should be done. My second question is the abolishing the destruction or demolition of the entire project at the Orion Heights here in East Boston, which I understand as the good congressman told me a second ago, is a city's ordinance. This is something that's those buildings are strong as the Rock of Gibraltar. And, you know, these are things that is a wasteful chain of money. They have leaped the area has been taped off and is going to do it half section at a time. The people have disappeared in one day, it seems. I don't know where they're setting them up, probably in hotels or whatever. And this is another multi-million dollar situation. All right. And I do have the good congressman's number. I have a question I don't want to air on the air. I will call him tomorrow. This is my both questions, and that is it.
Feel free to call us anytime. The office is open during regular office hours, and if we can help in any way, we will. The Orion Heights ones, I'm going to have to beg off that one. That's a local decision, both local city and state decision as to what to do with their properties. And they have been trying to rehab. I'm not actually that familiar with this particular project, but they've been trying to rehab a lot of their properties for many, many years now, one at a time. There's a lot of housing in Boston, and a lot of it needs a facelift. I don't know enough about that particular project to answer the question tonight. I guess I'll have somebody take a look at it tomorrow, maybe catch me up on it. As far as, you know, drug prices, I have to go back to what was earlier said. I mean, drug prices are a problem in this country, and until the U.S. government decides to negotiate, and the VA, you're right, is different. The VA has its own healthcare system with it, does handle drugs just exactly the way I talked about. They negotiate the prices, and that's what that's all about. And all I want to do for Medicare and private insurance is to do exactly for everybody else, exactly what we do for veterans, negotiate the prices of the drug companies, and if they don't want to meet it, then they don't get to sell their drugs in this country, which, of course, they will meet it because they can still make a profit. I'm not trying to say, you know, sell something that costs you $50 to make for a dollar. I'm saying a reasonable price, a reasonable profit to keep people employed, to keep people healthy, and to keep innovation going. It can be done. Thanks, Bob. And give us a call tomorrow.
Our next question is from Samuel, who would like to talk about the Affordable Care Act. Samuel, your question?
Yes, Congressman, thank you. My question is, there are millions of people right now on Obamacare, and the goal of the Republican Congress is to repeal and replace. The question is, what will happen, what is required to repeal and replace it, and what will happen to the millions of people that are on Obamacare today that are likely to not have health care moving forward? What will be done in the interim and moving forward?
Samuel, that's a classic question that there's no way I can answer. I supported Obamacare. I'm glad I did. It had problems. I mean, I'd love to have an opportunity to fix the problems it had, both the ones that we knew at the time, that I thought at the time, and the ones that have come up since then that we didn't foresee. That's not what our Republican friends have been talking about from the day we passed it. And again, this is a classic situation of the dog who caught the bus. You know, they've been chasing this now. They've said, oh, we're going to repeal. It started out repeal. Then they realized that a lot of people liked it, not because it's perfect, but because it was better than what we had before. And then they went to repeal in place. Not to this day, they have never put forth a proposal on what they want to replace it with. They are having their own internal debates about how to do it. They cannot do it and still do what they want to do, which is to keep the, quote, parts that are liked the best. Because those parts, the parts like portability, the parts about accepting people into health insurance with pre-existing conditions, the parts about keeping children on health insurance through the age of 26 when they graduate college, all that thing, those are things people love, people want, and people will fight to keep. And the Republicans know that. They've learned that lesson. But they're expensive. They cost money. And in order to do that, you have to raise taxes somewhere from somehow. Maybe they'll have a better idea than we had. That's fine. I'm open to that. But that's not what they've talked about. They have talked about repealing it. And I'm going to tell you right now, Samuel, they cannot do it. It cannot be done. They replace it in a way that they think is cheaper because health care is expensive. They will not tackle the difficult questions, and if they do it, millions of Americans will get hurt. Tens of millions of Americans will get hurt. They'll be thrown off health insurance, and we'll be back to the same situation we had before. And I think if they did that, America will revolt. But we will see. Again, that is one of the many things they promised to do it. They promised to do it first, so we'll know about it in January. And if they don't keep their promise, it means that they lied about the most vocal thing they talked about for the last 6 years, which is repealing Obamacare. Let's see if they're going to do it, and let's see what they come up with. I don't think they can do it in a way that the American people will accept, but we'll see.
Jerry is joining us now with a question about the Green Line. Jerry, your question?
Hi. I'm a little concerned. I've been hearing about that Green Line for years, and I want to know if I have never heard that for a federal project that you go to the cities to get money, and our mayor is going to give $50 million that he wants to float another bond, and it's like the first federal project that I've ever heard of that you don't get the money from the cities, and why are we paying that kind of money?
I can tell you, Jerry, that that is not a federal requirement. That is the state requiring the city to come up with money. The federal requirement has always been a shared match with the state on everything. The Red Line extension that came to Cambridge and Somerville, every project that's ever been done, the highways, it's always been a federal match. federal match when I was younger. It used to be 80% federal and 20% state. But for the last, 30 years, 20 years, whatever it was, it's been closer to a 50-50 match. So that for every dollar the federal government puts up, the state comes up with a dollar of its own money, which is what your state gas tax goes to. In this particular case, for the first time ever, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts decided to have the cities contribute to it. They say they're getting some of the benefit, they're getting all the benefit, and that's true. They decided to have the cities kick in. My argument has always been, if that's going to happen, which, again, that is a state thing, not a federal thing, that's Governor Baker and his administration, if that's what they're going to do, they better do it for every state project that they do from this point forward. Not just subways, but also highways and boats and everything else. No governor has ever done that before. And now that they're trying to make it into policy, it better be done fairly, because if not, they're going to have a lawsuit on their hand for discrimination. And we'll see what happens. But I want to be real clear. That is not a federal requirement. If the federal government has nothing to do with that, that is a state requirement.
James is joining us now with a question about clean energy tax credits. James, your question?
Hi. Thank you for pulling this telephone town hall. I'm trying to get MBTA to do stuff like this. My question is about the expiring clean energy tax credits. They're expiring at the end of this year. They were left out of last year's omnibus on accident. They're supposed to be added in this year, extended until 2022. And I'm wondering what you guys are doing to fix that, because the deadline's coming, and they haven't been extended yet.
I don't know if they'll be extended by the end of the year. I think I'm expecting that they might be kicked down the road a couple of months to give us an opportunity to do that. But right now there has been no discussion about extending. The other side doesn't believe in those things. And we'll have to wait and see where they do it. Those tax credits go to businesses, and they've employed an awful lot of people. And they're good for our environment. To me, that's a win-win. When you're employing Americans in decent-paying jobs, and you're cleaning our environment, and lowering our energy bills, what's the problem? But we'll wait and see. This is one of the many things that we're going to find out. It doesn't have to be done literally by December 31st, because taxes, for the most part, aren't due until April, so that it can go a little bit into the next year without a real problem, but not very long. And right now there has been almost no discussion about it. So we'll see what they do. And I wish I could tell you. I just don't know. I mean, it's generally that has almost always fallen, not 100%, but pretty close to 100% along party lines. Democrats believe in it. Republicans have not. They now run the world, and we'll have to wait and see what they do with it.
Al is joining us now with a question about Davis-Bacon provisions. Al, your question?
Yeah, the infrastructure plan, I know the Republican government's in power now. Will the Davis-Bacon provisions be on the table?
They're always on the table. Every year we have a vote on this. Every year some Republicans try to strike Davis-Bacon wage requirements. And so far we've been able to defeat it. We'll see. I expect they will. Actually, the last 2 weeks I've been hearing a lot more talk about a federal right-to-work law. I haven't seen anything like that yet. But we've been hearing talk about it. We'll have to wait and see. I believe in good wages for people who are working for the very – I want to go back to what we talked about a few minutes ago, which is income inequality. The Davis-Bacon laws are one of the laws that basically requires that your workers share some of the benefits of getting paid a lot of money to build highways and roads and whatever else it might be. That's what Davis-Bacon is. It says they have to be paid a decent wage. I think it's been – again, that law, in my opinion, has been great for America. And I think we need to not just keep that law. I think I'd love to expand it, but, you know, it is what it is. Every year we make the fight. Thus far, we win it on a regular basis. I think we'll continue to win it, but I'm not going to make any promises with my Republican friends now running Washington.
Our next question comes from Colin, who would like to talk about how the Democrats plan to work with the Republican majorities. Colin, your question?
Yes, Congressman, my question is, because the Republicans have the Congress, they have the Senate and the House and presidency, and I want to know what the strategy is for the Democrats to come back, or, you know, all that have been accomplished over the last 8 years So what strategy are you planning to use to do this?
I wish I could answer that question clearly and precisely, Colin, but I can't. A lot of Democrats right now, including me, we're trying to look in the mirror and try to figure out what went wrong, and what can we do better, and what can we focus on. And no one has an answer, a specific answer. It's going to be a big, long discussion amongst the activist Democrats around the country. I personally have thought for a long time that we haven't talked about our economic message to the working class and the middle class of America. We have focused way more on items that are important to smaller segments of America. They're important issues, but they don't say anything to the average working man and woman in this country. And I think not the policy is wrong, but the emphasis of what we talk about and the emphasis of items we discuss. I personally think that I'm a very progressive man on almost most issues, but the best progressive program I know of is A Good Job, because then people who are making money, people who can pay their bills and see a good future for themselves and their children, tend to be a little bit more open-hearted when it comes to some of the more progressive items like providing subsidies for housing, for allowing their neighbors to live a free life unhindered by social mores. All that being said, I know that's probably the major discussion going on around the country with active Democrats is what do we do wrong, what can we do better, and let's get back to work at it, because this is a struggle for the hearts and minds of the American people, and it never stops. Right now, we just lost an election, and I think people have to realize that and understand it. There are consequences to elections. There are major differences between the parties. And the American people made a choice. So let's see if they really, really, really want the choice that they just made. And I hope Democrats come up with a more thoughtful way to present our side over the next few years. But we'll see.
We have time for just a couple more questions this evening. And if we do not get to your question, we do apologize. You will have an opportunity at the end of this telephone community meeting to leave a voicemail for Congressman Capuano. And we will have a transcript of this telephone community meeting up on our website as soon as it's ready, which is capuano.house.gov. Our next question is from Bob, and it relates to immigration and sanctuary cities. Bob, your question?
Hi, my question is we hear a lot about the immigration and that President-elect Trump wants to target people from Syria and other areas. And a lot of people are saying that that's unconstitutional, it's un-American to do that. But the 1952 McCarran-Walter Act, which is Public Law 414, Chapter 2, Section 212, excludes certain immigrants who are unlawful, immoral, in any way politically radical, deceased, and from certain countries. It gives the president the power to restrict and deport targeted immigrants. And because Somerville and Cambridge are sanctuary cities, and the president-elect said that he was going to cut funding to states that have these sanctuary cities, and the mayor of Somerville has stated that, yes, we are a sanctuary city, that projects like the extension of the Green Line, that money is going to fade out if the cities don't come around and say, okay, we're not going to be a sanctuary city. How can you address that? And what about the 1952 McCarran-Walter Act, which was, as far as I know, the last time it was used by President Jimmy Carter?
Well, I can't speak to the McCarran Act. I'm not that familiar with it. I know a little bit about it, but you certainly know a lot more about it than I do. So I won't speak to that one. As far as the sanctuary cities go, this has been, in my opinion, one of the most overblown discussions during the entire political season. And it related to a terrible tragedy in San Francisco where a person would have been deported, should have been deported again for the third time, killed a young woman out in San Francisco. And they blamed it somehow because San Francisco was too nice. And I don't know what goes on in San Francisco. I can tell you unequivocally, Somerville, Cambridge, Boston, I think Chelsea is a sanctuary city. In the greater Boston area, the way the sanctuary city rules have applied, and they're mostly local ordinances, is very simple. They tell their local police, we do not want to crowd our jails. Somerville is a classic example. I don't remember the exact number. We only have 10 or 12 cells. There's only a few people we can lock up at night. And if every single person we stopped for running a red light or jaywalking had their immigration status checked, those jail cells would be and arrested for simply the immigration status, those jail cells would be filled overnight. And then you can multiply that to Lawrence and Lowell and Springfield and lots of now suburban cities as well. So the local communities made a decision that said, look, you know, we're going to enforce our laws, we're going to enforce our rules, but on that one issue, if that's all the problem is, we're just not going to, you know, prioritize it with our police. However, that never said, to my knowledge, it has never been used to say someone who is stopped for running a red light, if they're wanted for a bank robbery, they get arrested and they get prosecuted on the bank robbery, and then the immigration stuff comes in. So the sanctuary city laws, in my opinion, the way they have been interpreted, at least by the media, are never the way they have been implemented, number one. Number two is if Mr. Trump and his administration wants to come at them, first of all, they have to get a law passed, which will take some time to target those kinds of things. Second of all, you know, let's assume he can get it passed, which honestly, in today's political atmosphere, I expect he will be able to get it passed if they push it and push it and push it, but we'll see. But let's assume he can get it passed. All the city has to do is just change its ordinance. All the ordinance is a commentary on policy. And honestly, when we did it in Somerville, the local police wanted us to do it because they didn't want to fill up the jail cells like that. That's not what they wanted to do. They wanted to focus on real crime that impacted real people, house breaks, automobile thievery, problems at bars late at night, whatever, the kinds of things that really impact the average citizens of those communities. So that it can be done a thousand different ways. And again, the alternative is to fill up our jail cells in every, not just urban area, but every suburban area as well, waiting months upon months for the INS to do it. I also want to be real clear. Every single police officer in this country exercises discretion every minute of every day. And I say that because if not, every one of us would be arrested for speeding. No one can look me in the eye and tell me the last time they were on Route 93 that people weren't going over 55 miles an hour. Not just one or two people, but hundreds, if not the entire people on the entire group of people on the road at the time. And every one of them has broken the law. And if they wanted to enforce the speed limit on every one of them, they could legally have the right to do it, but it would be just administratively impossible to do it, so therefore they pick and choose. And I'd say the same thing with this. There are so many people here because we have been so lax in, number one, enforcing our laws, and number two, try to straighten out our laws after we realize we went so long period of time without enforcing them. It just cannot be done. It's like the same nonsense about deporting 12 million people. It is a frightening statement. It is intended to be a frightening statement, but it is also physically impossible. I don't see this country doing that. So when it comes to the sanctuary cities, I think the cities can handle it. If they're smart about it, they can go to court to defend themselves. I think they'll win under absent change in federal law. And if federal law is changed for any particular reason, they can still have the same policy under a different format if that's what they choose to do. If they want to give up the federal money, that'll be up to them to make that decision when the time comes. I think that would be probably unnecessary, but I think we have a long ways until we get to that.
And that is all we have time for this evening. We do apologize if we could not get to your question tonight, but you will have an opportunity at the end of this telephone community meeting to leave a voicemail for Congressman Capuano. Thank you again for joining us, and I would like to turn the forum back over to the Congressman. Congressman Capuano?
Thank you, Alison. I just want to thank everybody who spent some time with us tonight. I know that, again, people come on and off these phone calls. And I just want to appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. I hope you found it enlightening. I wish I had more concrete answers for some of the questions, but as I said right from the beginning, I cannot predict the future. I can only give you my best estimate as to what might happen, what priorities the new administration might have. But I can tell you that as far as I'm concerned, we'll remain open to your comments and concerns and suggestions, and we will remain vigilant to maintain the type of America that the people of Massachusetts want to see. We will fight for it with everything we have, and I feel confident that in the end, we will end up with the country that we want and deserve. So with that, I'm going to say again, thank you all very much for spending some time with us, and good night, and have a great holiday season.